Chapter 6 "Today we're going to head back to Raylan Kor," Warfather Doreth, the High Priest who had led the march, announced to everyone at dawn formation with a wicked grin. "But we're not going in one large column. Starting every 15 minutes after this assembly, one squad will be sent back. Overland. The Ancients and War Brothers will be patrolling the road and enforcing the rules. You may cross it, but do not travel upon it. The purpose of this training is this. Often a unit gets broken off from its supply and has to forage on its own. It is a test of any neophyte's temper and any squad's effectiveness to be able to survive in hostile territory and navigate back to your command. Today you need to find your way back to the fortress without our help." There was a loud groan at the news, but it perked up a lot of the young men. Moving in small groups had to be better than marching in formation. "To make things interesting," the commandant added, over the cadets' murmur, "we have 7 teams of foes betwixt here and Raylan Kor, either guarding strategic points or searching for cadets to engage. They will be wearing yellow and red tabards with the arms of Raylan Kor upon them. They will be armed with wooden swords. They are eager to keep each of you away from your camp as long as possible. Engage or evade them as you see fit. But if they capture you, your role in the competition is over. Oh, yes, there is a grand feast awaiting to reward the first full squadron who returns," the sage old Warfather grinned. That was plenty of incentive for every neophyte there. The 3rd squad, 2nd company, did not depart until mid-morning, with a young monk, Warbrother Thurgar, accompanying them for the first half-day, to ensure they did not blunder too far off the path. But the monk got less and less helpful as they went, until he had gone completely silent. It was up to them, he indicated, to find their way. He would merely follow them. "If we just keep heading south, we're bound to run into the road eventually," reasoned Rax. "And run into the foe as well," Walden pointed out, "not to mention every other squad, who can't think of a better plan than that." Brother Thurgar smirked. "South, then bear east for a while," suggested Gurrendor. "We can range wide of the opposition and then head south."
"That would take too long," complained Handel. "We've been marching for 2 days with little to eat. I don't want to march 3 or 4 more with less."
"Then use your heads before you use your feet," counseled the War Brother, when some of the boys beseeched him with their eyes. "The solution is there."
Something dawned on Rundle.
Fellows, why use our feet at all?" he asked.
The others looked at him strangely.
"You have a spell that can fly us all the way back, Sparky?"
asked Walven. Rondal ignored the jibe. Walven didn't mean anything by it.
"No,"
Rondal admitted, "but we might be able to float back." He recalled the map of the region he had committed to magical memory in his days leading up to the opening of the mysteries at Raylan Kor. He thought it might be useful. And it was. He took a few moments to sketch it out in the dirt with a stick.
"According to the map," he said slowly, "we're in the forest, here, so if we bear east and north, we can come to the Partaline River. That flows south and west. Remember that great bridge we crossed? It comes within 6 miles of Raylan Kor," he pointed out,
"bypassing most of the defenders and most of our opponent squads.
And you're going to turn our shields into dainty little sailboats, I expect?" asked Dolwyn with a smirk.
"We'll deal with that when we get to the river," decided Verd, the chosen leader for the day. "We can steal a boat or make a raft, but that sounds like a better course than marching again."
The War Brother did not comment, but Rondal could tell he seemed pleased.
"There is one more thing," Brother Thurgar said, as they prepared to depart. "At the end of this journey, your unit will choose your war name for you. That name you will keep with you for the rest of your life, and will be known to your brothers as such. Try not to make it one you're embarrassed to carry. Good luck, and may Duin guide your path," he said, adding a blessing before he headed back toward the road.
"Harris would be a better guide," grumbled Rax.
"And the Goblin King better company," griped Yeetin.
"Let's make for the river," Verd ordered. "The faster we get there, the faster we can decide what a horrible mistake we've made."
They made it through the woods surprisingly fast,
and crossed the few miles of fields and pastures until they got to the sluggish Partalin. It wasn't particularly wide, the Magi informed their mates, after a little scrying, but it was deep. They found a small punt nearby, large enough for only one man, and sent Yeetin, who claimed some familiarity with boats, upriver in it, to scout, while the rest of them stood around and speculated just how quickly the weak mage would get himself drowned. Surprisingly, he returned on the punt with a small rowboat in tow. A similar journey downriver secured two more small craft, and before long, a flotilla of stolen boats made their way down the deep stream.
"This is much better than marching,"
Rack sighed pleasantly as he paddled along. "So far," agreed Walvin. "But don't get complacent, and don't be lazy on the paddle. If we get back first..." They hadn't discussed that prospect, but the idea of a feast was alluring, so much so that the three magi, after consultation, began enchanting their journey. Only in small ways. Rondol lacked the power to conjure a proper water elemental, but they did manage to arcanely reduce the friction of the boat somewhat. The bank slipped past them at a goodly pace for miles, as they skipped the long, painful road full of fake enemies who would beat them up. Along the way, they discussed everything from girls to their futures, to girls to their hopes and plans after graduation, to girls. Twice they saw fellow cadets on the banks as they floated by, fellows who had figured out the expediency of river travel late, but the Rakiel squad passed them in good order, without challenge. They found themselves at one point facing a bridge toll, and had to convince the bridgekeeper to let them pass without paying. That took a fair amount of intimidation from the boys, but eventually the man relented, and opened the river gate to let their craft through, while Dolwyn stood menacingly behind him. Their journey continued.
"I'm getting hungry," complained Rax, late in the afternoon. "I've been hungry for days," agreed Dolwyn.
"What are we going to do about that?"
"We could steal food,"
Pandol suggested anxiously.
"We could buy it if we had money," agreed Orphil dejectedly, "but I seem to have forgotten my coin purse. My belly is dancing with my backbone."
"Why can't one of you idiots fish?"
demanded Yeetin from his punt.
"It would take too long to stop and cook it," Walvin decided.
"Sparky, you've got that magical map in your head. What is the next village we come to?"
Grinwyn Estate, domain of Clairbury," Rondol supplied. He really hoped his new war name was not going to be Sparky. It was a common term for war magi, the way you could always call the camp cook Cookie, or the company medic as Doc. But still.
"Do they have an inn there?"
"The map I studied didn't specify," Rondol said dryly, "and we have no money, besides."
"My father,"
Dolwyn said slowly, "always said that gold might not get you good swords, but good swords will always get you gold."
"Our swords are wooden,"
Rax pointed out unhelpfully. "Does that get us wood?"
"I've got enough wood already," he joked.
No one laughed. The novelty of penis jokes had faded weeks ago.
"No one else knows our swords are wooden,"
Walvin pointed out. "In fact, apart from that, we look like any mercenary troop."
"Of children,"
snorted Rax.
"Of young recruits,"
corrected Walvin evenly. "Plenty of lads our age enter military service, and with helmets on it's hard to tell our ages, especially in the darkness, of which we should soon have an abundance."
"So, we're going to steal someone's food at the point of a wooden sword?"
"No," Walvin said, smiling. "We're going to convince them to give it to us." The village of Grinwyn was on the edge of its domain, the river acting as the border of the land. There was no bridge there, but there was a decent ford, and the boys were able to drag their boats onto the bank without discovery. Under Walvin's guidance, the squad formed up under their thin cloaks, spears in hand, and marched not toward a village inn, but toward the manor hall of Grinwyn Estate. It was a squat, one-story affair, at least a century old, but there was a three-story refuge tower there for defence, empty, the Magi declared, upon inspection, and no less than 5 grain silos. Walvin, who acted as leader by acclamation, pulled his helmet down over his eyes until they were barely visible, and encouraged the rest of them to follow suit. They marched in good order to the unguarded gate of the well-kept manor, where they rang the bell. The gatekeeper shuffled out of his shed to see them, lifting a lantern high and peering into the shadows. Everyone kept their shields up. In the darkness it was hard to see the wooden points of the practice weapons they bore.
"What is this?"
demanded the rustic watchman.
"We've come to arrest the Lord of the Manor," Walden said, authoritatively.
"What? Sir Andrus? Why?"
the man cried in alarm.
"Because those are our orders," Walden insisted. "Open this door at once, or we will storm the manor."
To emphasize his point, the rest of the squad brandished their spears menacingly.
All right,"
agreed the man in panic as he opened the latch.
"By whose authority are you?"
Rondel touched the man and whispered a word, and he fell instantly asleep.
"I like that,"
Rax smiled as they helped the guard to the ground.
"It's much neater than slitting his throat."
"Spread out," ordered Walden, gesturing. "Secure the stable, the front door, and the side door. Gorondor, you and Handal take the rear." The boys scattered out as commanded without questioning Walven's orders. They had learned the importance of obedience on the drill field. In moments, they had effective control of the manor.
"If I'd known conquest was this easy,"
Joffard grinned.
"It helps when they don't know you're coming,"
said Walven. "But you fellows just back up what I say, stand around and look menacing, and we'll be fed before you know it." He led the rest of the squad to the door of the manor, where he pounded until someone came. As soon as the door opened, he pushed his way in.
"Where is Sir Andrus?"
he demanded of the confused old woman.
"What? Trink take you, the master isn't bored,"
she insisted angrily. Walven put his hand dangerously on the hilt of his wooden sword.
"Then lead us to him," the boy said, his eyes narrow. "We would have words with him, and be sharp about it," he insisted.
The woman wailed and led the cadets back to the great hall of the manor. Three men and two women sat at a trestle table.
"Seize him,"
Walven ordered. Rondal was surprised at the command, but marched forward to where the oldest man was sitting and grabbed his left arm as Dolwyn grabbed his right. They dragged the old man to Walven, who was looking at him appraisingly.
"Sir Andrus of Devas, you are hereby bound by law by the rightful—"
"Wait! Wait!"
the old man squealed.
"You have the wrong man! You have the wrong man!"
"What?"
Walven said scornfully.
"I think not.
Sir Andrus of Devas, you have—"
"But I'm not Sir Andrus of Devas,"
the old knight insisted, shaking the boy's hands off.
"I'm Sir Andrus of Culwin. I've never even heard of Devas."
"What?" Walven said, feigning surprise.
"I said I've never even heard of Devas. Ishi's itchy bum, I've never even left the county.
So, your liege lord is not Oscott, Baron of Druin?"
Walven asked, confused.
"No, never heard of the man,"
the knight insisted.
"That's just what a fugitive might say, Captain,"
Rondel offered helpfully.
"So it is,"
Walven agreed, his eyes narrowing.
"Can you prove you are not indeed Sir Andrus of Devas?
Fetch my patent. Rockwilly, fetch my patent of nobility,"
he shouted, apparently to his maidservant.
"Quickly,"
he insisted, terrified.
"This is highly irregular, Captain,"
Rondel pointed out to Walven, playing the part of the officious clerk.
"If he's not Sir Andrus of Devas,"
Walven said, just loudly enough for the man to overhear, "then what will we do? This is most embarrassing."
"Slaughter them all, Captain,"
Rondal suggested evilly.
"We'll see," shrugged the cadet.
The fat little maid brought a sheaf of parchment bearing many seals, attesting that the man was indeed Sir Andrus of Culwin, not the miscreant Sir Andrus of Devas. Walven appeared reluctant to accept his story, and even ordered his men to prepare to burn the manor down, when Andrus finally broke down and pleaded for his life and livelihood.
"Well, I hate to report a failure,"
murmured Walven, "and I was ordered to arrest Sir Andrus, and I don't think my commander really cares which Sir Andrus is supplied, yet—"
"Sir,"
Rondel said respectfully, "perhaps if the men were fed and rested while we sort this out, it might keep them from getting anxious," he said, casting his eyes toward his squadmates.
"Yes, yes, by all means, Captain,"
Sir Andrus said, his eyes wide.
"Have a seat, let us feed you. You must be weary."
"Well," Walven said, appearing to waver, "if this is the wrong manner, and you are the wrong Sir Andrus—"
"I am, my lords, I am,"
he insisted.
"Please,
There's been a mistake. Let's talk about this like reasonable gentlemen.
The entire squad ate well that night, raiding the manor's pantry for food and drink, then stuffing their pockets with more, all at the urging of the frightened manor staff. When Walvin was satisfied, he finally agreed to leave without further attempts to arrest Sir Andras.
And that, gentlemen, the squad leader said as he led them back to the boat in darkness, is how you rob a manor house.
I've done it before, Rondal dismissed, but we didn't even really use magic on this one.
Impressive, he admitted.
I'm happy with the results, agreed Rax, picking his teeth with a twig. Now let's see just how far downstream we can make it tonight.
The boys almost missed their landing the next morning, as they made better time than they expected. But Rondal, alert with his mage map, got them to stop and hauled their boats ashore just before they arrived at the bridge closest to Raylan Kaur. As restive as their journey downriver had been, they were eager to be underway.
Only 6 miles, scoffed Verd as they began to march. That's nothing.
Even Yeetin seemed eager to get going. They moved quietly through the countryside, alongside the road to Raylan Kaur, and were nearly there when they ran into a knot of yellow and red-clad warriors bearing wooden swords, some of the defenders the Warfather had promised them.
There are 7 of them, moaned Rax, as they peered up the road from cover.
There are 10 of us,
Yeetin pointed out.
9, corrected Dolwyn scornfully.
Look at the size of them. Regardless, we outnumber them,
Yeetin said, and we need not engage them. We can always go around.
That doesn't look practical, Walvin suggested. Not unless we want to backtrack upriver and try to get through the swamps. That could take hours, and the fortress is just beyond them.
Then what do we do?
Let's attack, Rondal decided. He was elected leader again the night before, after the successful raid on the manor.
I'm tired of skulking around, and we don't have to kill them, he reminded. We just have to get past them.
Attack? Asked Walvin, curious. I didn't think you were the aggressive type. Why not use some spell?
I've had occasion to learn recently, Rondal said dryly, and while I'm sure there's some clever magical device I could use to achieve our goal, the truth is I'm sick and tired of skulking about. Our camp is right over there, and I need a hot meal and a warm blanket more than the breath of life itself. There are only 7 of them, and how many times have we been told that a sudden, all-out attack, with no regard for our personal safety, was often the best tactic to take in an engagement?
I thought that was just bluster,
Yeetin whined.
It was good advice, Orphil agreed, but I still don't want to get creamed the moment we stick our heads out there.
We won't, Rondal assured. Remember, we only have to get past them. We don't have to defeat them.
And how do you propose to do that?
Rondal looked around.
Someone needs to steal some rope.
It took almost 30 minutes for the boys to round up what they needed by raiding a peasant's shed under Rondal's direction, and if they were skeptical about the plan, they couldn't conceive of a better one. It began with the smallest of the squad, Verd, apparently blundering out into the road in front of the guards without his helm, shield, or sword. He looked for all the world like a cadet who got separated from his unit. The yellow-clad guards grinned and gave chase, most of them, leaving only 2 guarding the entry to Raylan Kaur. While Verd led his heavily armored pursuers on a merry chase through the village, the other boys surprised the remaining guards. To keep from getting bogged down in a protracted engagement, Rondal had the largest 2 boys pick up the small punt and rush the defenders with it, using it as a giant shield against their blows. Immediately behind it ran 4 more boys, who sprung out against the bowled over guards and bashed their helmets with their wooden swords while the others passed by. Meanwhile, Verd rounded a corner of the road and ducked into an alley between 2 hovels, and nimbly leapt over the rope they'd stretched between. In their cumbersome helmets, their attention on Verd, the warriors didn't see the rope until it was too late. By the time they untangled themselves from it, Verd had sprinted away to follow his mates.
All right, Rondal bellowed as the gate of Raylan Kaur came into sight. Let's form up. Marching formation. Banner bearer to the front.
We did it,
Rax chortled in delight. I can't believe that worked.
We're not there yet, Rondal said grimly. Somehow I don't think that will be the last obstacle in our path. Not a good time to get complacent.
As if he was prophesying, Five more knights in yellow and black tabards sprang out from the brush beside the causeway and challenged the squad on its way back to camp. Much to Rondel's surprise, he recognized one of the men under his helmet.
Tyndall!
He spat angrily, for no real reason. He hadn't seen his fellow apprentice in almost a full moon, and apart from some general resentment over what happened at Inarion, he hadn't spared him much thought. But the sight of his grinning face under the visor of the helmet enraged Rondal for some reason. He had originally planned on trying to skirt the causeway, but as soon as he saw Tyndall, he changed his plan.
"Here she's, tits! All right!" he called out. "Shields to the front! Spears behind! Wedge formation with Rax and Verd on the rear guard! Scorpion's tail team! Yeetin, keep the banner in the center, right behind Jofard! We hit them hard and keep going! Watch for magic! That one on the end is a war mage, and I'll take care of him! The rest of you battle on through and don't stop until you're on the practice field! We've got to be at least fourth or fifth place at this point!"
"Maybe fifth," Gurrendor said dejectedly.
"It doesn't matter if we're last. We go in there like we're the first," he insisted. "Take your positions. Make ready to charge," he shouted, as the boys quickly reformed according to his direction. He took a deep breath, surveying the backs of the helmets of his squad. He didn't care if they got the snot beat out of them, he realized. They were going through that causeway. "And strike!" They marched along at quick order, without calling a cadence. It only took moments for the defenders to recognize an attack and arm themselves. But Rondal didn't care. They set up a defensive shield wall, but it was ragged and undisciplined. When they arrived within 20 feet of the most forward-positioned defender, Rondal ordered the charge. The front two squadmates, Jofard and Orphil, kept their shields locked together as they appeared in force and used their big shields to bully their way through the first two defenders, both armed with wooden greatswords. The spearmen behind them growled and entangled the defenders' blades just long enough to allow the boys on either side to beat their helmets soundly as they passed.
"Dead!"
Jofard bellowed with each resounding slap of wood against metal. Walven leapt out and assailed two defenders on their flanks, armed with wooden cavalry swords and shields. Gurrendor slipped in behind him to support his ferocious assault, and between the two the left flank was secure. Rondel kept to the right flank, and when the front shields pushed past the others, he found himself shield to shield with his fellow apprentice. He felt Walven float quietly behind him, spear ready to support his attack. Tyndall couldn't see that, but Tyndall grinned broadly through the bars, his shaggy blonde hair hanging out of the borrowed practice helmet like too much hay in a barn.
"Hey, run!" he began to say.
"I saw..." Rondel didn't hesitate. As Dolwyn, in front of him and on his left, pushed Tyndall's cavalry shield slightly out of line, Rondel threw his elbow up as if he was feinting for a headstrike. Tyndall reflexively raised his shield, but did not cant it enough to avoid the hard snap Rondal's increasingly strong wrist brought to bear when he snapped it back over the shield. There was a mighty thud of wood on steel, and Tyndall was reeling from the blow. Rondel didn't spare him another glance.
"Keep moving,"
he ordered, as the scorpion's tail moved in behind. That was a formation that put most of the spears in the rear, allowing them to rove to the left, right, or over the heads of the front shieldmen. As they passed by the shattered line of defenders, the spears were able to strike swiftly at the disorganized defenders, keeping them from regrouping, or even rising. Rondal heard another hard clunk behind him, and he knew that Handel's fake spear had smashed against Tyndall's helmet, hard.
"Rakiels, form up to the practice field," Rondel ordered. "Double time."
They reformed into a better dressed line and began to trot, a difficult thing to do with a full pack and arrayed for battle. But the boys were no longer unused to such burdens, and the prospect of food and rest and sleep so close at hand was too alluring for them to let weariness interfere. Rax began to sing a particularly dirty marching song concerning the proclivities of the whores of Barrowbell, that finished up scandalously, just as the squad marched boldly into the practice field. There were already some cadets there, and Rondal's heart fell. He almost thought that they would be the first. It was a foolish hope, but it had kept him going for a few miles. But then he realized that the boys milling around were there in singles and doubles. Four was the most he saw standing together around their shredded banner,
and it looked like it took all four of them to keep it aright. But nothing close to a full squad. The third squad, second company was, as the war brother at the gate informed them, the first complete squadron to make it back. The others had not been permitted to sound the great horn at the reviewing stand, not until the largest squad had been determined.
"You mean we won?"
asked Joffard in a girlish whisper.
"Indeed, by Duin's grace," chuckled the pleased warrior monk. "You may sound the horn at will."
"Let's do this right," Rondal said, like a man suddenly possessed. "Form up. Parade block. Yeetin on the banner. Ready? March! Walvin, call the cadence." He grinned. The bystanders broke into applause and shouts of praise. Instead of tearing after the prize like they were attacking it, Rondal brought them in as a disciplined unit. As the Rakiel squad marched into the field and took up their parade position, it felt like every instructor, monk and ancient in Raylan Kor had come out to watch. "Squadron, halt!" ordered Rondal. His fellows obligingly came to a stop and rested their spears in one disciplined movement as ancient Fezlin approached, grinning.
"Third squadron, second company, reporting as ordered, sir,"
Rondal said, saluting with his spear and shield after calling his squad to attention. Their ancient stood at attention and returned the salute, then formally bowed.
"Well done, neophytes," he boomed. "Rakiel squad, you just won me a beefsteak dinner. Not that I'm complaining, but how did you get back here so quickly?"
he asked, amused but mystified.
"We took to the river and bypassed the road entirely, sir," Rondal called. "And the defenders at the gate? The squadron conducted a surprise attack using distraction, concocted an ambush, and kicked their asses, sir,"
Rondal said proudly.
"Then you have won," he pronounced. "Squad leader, please blow the horn of victory and then dismiss your men. You have 3 hours before your feast will be ready at the War Brothers' Chapel," he said, his wrinkled and scarred face breaking into a grin. "I would recommend you spend at least some of that time productively in the bathhouse. Squadron, dismissed," Rondal called, and then the boys followed him over to the stand after stacking their arms neatly in place. He took up the great ox horn, looked around at his excited fellows, and held it to his lips, blowing a mighty blast. It was a low, deep, rumbling sound that seemed to make his very bones vibrate. He didn't know why, but when he handed it to Walvin, he felt changed. He was watching with excitement as each of the squad, including Frail Yeetin, who had borne every burden asked and had done so without serious complaint, blew a blast on the horn. It was while the weakest member of the squad was celebrating that Tyndall approached, still wearing his yellow and black tabard.
"Ron," he called as he crossed the field. "Ron, that was amazing."
"What?" Rondal asked, confused.
"How you just plowed through us like that,"
the senior apprentice laughed.
"We were ready to take you apart, and you just didn't give us a chance. Why didn't you stick around to duel?"
he asked, sounding a little hurt.
"I wanted to see how good you've gotten."
"That wasn't part of our mission," the junior apprentice said coolly. "Our mission was to get past you, not defeat you." Tyndall snorted.
"Like you could ever defeat me."
Before Rondal could mount a defense, his squadmates beat him to it. Walvin was in Tyndall's face instantly.
"You fight him. You fight the whole fucking squad," the young man said in a serious voice. "I don't know what your problem with him is, but Stryker is an outstanding soldier," he continued aggressively, "and he got us through this trial without a hiccup. It was his idea to take the river."
"Stryker?"
asked Tyndall, confused.
"That's his war name,"
Verd insisted, the little bantam just as aggressive in Rondal's defense as the larger lad. "We just decided on the way up the causeway. Stryker, for how hard he struck you," he added with a sneer.
"Struck me?"
Tyndall asked, confused.
"Why don't you just scamper back to the fortress with the rest of the knights?"
Joffard asked, his hands on his hips. "This field is for the mysteries. Neophytes only. Your service as a target is appreciated, but you are dismissed. We need no interlopers here." Tyndall looked at Rondal thoughtfully, almost respectfully. Rondal didn't mind the change.
"Well, it looks like you have your own little band now, Ron," he said reluctantly. "I guess you don't need me keeping an eye on you."
"I never did," Rondal said, his jaw clenched.
Now please excuse me. My squad and I have some celebrating to do. He watched as Tyndall left without another word, and when he was gone, he felt as if yet another burden had been suddenly lifted from him. He had felt as if he was in Tyndall's shadow for the last few years, ever since he became Master Minolan's apprentice by default. It hadn't mattered that he was a better mage than Tyndall. The younger boy was more like their master than he was by nature and temperament. But now he found he didn't care as much. After Tyndall left, Rondol looked around at his celebrating squadmates and was glad that the other boy wasn't involved in this victory. It was something he had done on his own, earned on his own, without even his witchstone to rely on. He slowly started to grin as he realized that. He and his team had triumphed over everyone else, not because he was a high mage, or a mage knight, or a mage lord. Apart from a few fires and a little scrying, he'd done precious little magic at all. What he saw around him was the result of his own personal efforts. He hadn't borrowed anything, hadn't got any help from his master to win through the challenges of the mysteries. He had done this, he and his squad, on their own. For no particular reason, Rondol suddenly felt at ease, peaceful in a way that had eluded him most of his life. "Let's get back to camp," he ordered, when the squad's enthusiasm had banked. "A couple of hours of napping, a hot bath, and we can attack the banquet table." The feast was laid out in the War Brothers' Chapel, a long tent that served as the commander's lounge during the day when it wasn't being employed for instruction or services. The feast itself was a simple affair, but artfully prepared, and included all the food they could eat. Bread, fish, vegetables cooked in broth, and an entire goat was roasted for their meal, and another small barrel of ale was made available. The 10 boys were thoroughly elated, stuffing their faces like they were starving and drinking heavily after their grueling march. During the feast, each one was called upon to tell his part in the trial to the 3 war brothers and 2 ancients who attended. As they were now twice victorious in their contests, they were given a far more private rite than the mass of their fellow neophytes who were still trickling in. The final rite could only be performed for the full squad, so many ended up waiting on stragglers, their whole squads paying for the individual soldier's failure. The rite was solemn, with War Brother Thurgar lighting the sacred torches that called Duin's attention and giving to them the instruction in the mystery. "For 20 generations men have performed the mysteries," he said quietly, "to be initiated into a career of arms. The skills taught in the mysteries are valuable," he said, looking around at each of them in the torchlight. "But it is not the skills that elevate a man from being a mere soldier to being an initiate. The skills can be taught to anyone, even women, aye, in the defence of their homes at pressing need. But the men who complete the mysteries are bound together by bonds of sweat and blood. Duin's rites grant you his grace in your transformation. Less than a moon ago, you were competitors and strangers. You were boys who bore the names of your fathers or your homelands and looked forward to a life with a sword in your hand. Now," he said enthusiastically, "now you are brothers, your bonds forged from the toil and effort you have put into the mysteries. You have been made kin by your mutual suffering, your mutual dependence, and your loyalty to the mysteries. Are they difficult? Aye. Unfair? Aye. Brutal? Of necessity. A boy doesn't become a man over a cozy cup of tea. It takes fire, sweat, and blood. Effort. 2 hands, 2 feet. A head and a heart. And that must be heated and beaten in the mysteries, overseen by older men and initiates. Else the blade that results will be weak when it most needs to be strong. But Duin grants to all those who complete his mysteries an especial boon. Each squadron who completes the mysteries stands together in the sight of Duin after death, for the mysteries stay with the soul long after the body has grown cold. In the sight of Duin, your comrades will answer for you, sing of your deeds, testify to your valour, and share in Duin's judgment with you. For that is one of the mysteries. For he who picks up a sword in accordance with sacred law, to defend their homes or to attack another in conquest, he is blessed by the Red God. A man who is willing to lay down his life for his family, his people, his nation, that man is blessed in his sight, and his death shall be a time of great mourning and celebration. Be it for gold, or for honour, or for duty, the man who dies an initiate never dies alone, for each of you are now obligated to attend the funeral of your fellow initiates,
speak words over their grave, and help pray their souls to the halls of Duin the Destroyer. Rondel looked up at the warrior monk with a new appreciation for what the Warfather had been doing. He looked around the low table they were gathered around. From Rex, who would complain the gold you gave him was too shiny, to Jofard, who could inspire with his presence, yet took orders with soldierly grace, to Wolven, whose scheming mind and keen insight had allowed them to outthink their challenges, each of them had given something of themselves on this journey. He could have less stalwart squadmates, he decided. He had been fortunate. As rough as they had been coming into the mysteries, now they knew how to work as a unit. Duin's gift is death in battle, the war brother continued, while the priestesses of Ishi and Trig and Brigga champion the force of life, as they should. The gifts of the goddesses are for times of peace, and are there to bring comfort and growth. They are given to women first and foremost, for women bear the future of men. Duin's gift is granted to menfolk, and his mysteries reserved for us. For while we can serve the force of life, as Huin does, the ability to slay and conquer is the responsibility of men alone. When invaders pour over the frontier, and women and children are safely within stone walls, it is the men of the domain who take up arms and give their lives to defend them. On women, the gift of life is bestowed, and they are reminded of this in blood every month. On men is the gift of death bestowed. We are reminded of this by the blood that stains your blade. They were all silent for a few moments as they reflected on this. Rondel knew women fought. During the siege of Bovol, plenty had taken up arms or supported the militia manning the walls, and he knew there were some militant orders of priestesses, even war sisters. But he also knew that it was men who were the first in battle, and men who died first when invaders came. It was a heavy burden, knowing that to be a man meant dicing with death every time he picked up a sword. You all have been called to the mysteries. You are learning the brotherhood of arms, the rites of war, the secret sacred mysteries of attack, defense, obedience, and duty. For when you all fight together, united in purpose, giving up your autonomy as warriors in exchange for the glory of a unified purpose, the honor of service to your fellow soldiers. Valor, my sons, is its own reward. Beyond domains and lands, titles and riches, to take up a sword and shield with stout comrades at your side, that, my sons, that is Duin's true gift to men. The sermon concluded. Eventually the time came to choose their war names, an important part of the mysteries. Now that they had been in mock battle together, the rite required that their comrades grant them the name by which they would someday face the war god. War brother Thurgar oversaw the ritual, and called out the war name when it was presented to him with a loud, "Thus shall Duin greet thee as..." Rondal became Striker, by unanimous acclamation. Jofard became Giant, even though he wasn't exactly a giant. Handal became Hardhead, for how poorly he picked up on advice, and for how well he could take a blow to the head. Verd was called Fleet, because of his lightness and speed. Rax was to be known as Bloody, after the practice skirmish in which his helmet had torn his scalp, and he'd had to fight the rest of the day with a gruesome, bloody visage. Dolwyn became known as Fixer, for his facility with trading and arranging deals with other units. Orphil was called Crusher, for his fondness of the overhead stroke and preference for mass weapons. Wolven was given the name Ace, for his ability to lay out an opponent with one quick shot. Gurrendor was called Snake, for how stealthy he could be at need. And Yeetin, whom none suspected would persevere this far, or even live through the mysteries, was given the name of Shatter, mostly because he looked like he could shatter any time someone hit him. The scrawny mage grinned proudly when it was bestowed to him, though. Shatter had a lot more style than Yeetin, Rondel had to agree. The war brother solemnly officiated the giving of names, and allowed each cadet the opportunity to speak a few words about his experience. When the last name had been given, he gave Duin's blessing to them all, led them in a few hymns to the war god, and drank a cup of strong red wine with each of them before dismissing them for the night. They walked back to camp slowly, thinking about the warrior monk's sermon and its meaning. As most of the cadets had yet to return from their mission, the camp was quiet for once.
Rondal called a final formation, in which he thanked them all for their service and valour, and called them each by their war name. Then he oversaw the election of the next day's leader, and crawled gratefully into his blanket. For 2 days, the third squad had light duty, as one by one the other squads wandered in. By the time the rest day dawned, almost all of the cadets had returned. War brothers rode through the countryside looking for a few stragglers, but the rest of the cadets were back at work. Thankfully, most of that work was mere instruction in the laws of war from the sacred book of Duin. They learned the laws and rites devoted to siege warfare. They learned how a mercenary who was hired for garrison duty could not be used to fight in a conquest without his leave. They learned the structure of rank in the new Royal Army and in various mercenary armies. They learned a soldier's duty to a civilian, a non-combatant, and an insurgent. They learned the penalties for insubordination and disobedience, for being drunk on duty, and for falling asleep on guard. They learned the rites and hymns sung at a brother's funeral, the proper greetings and salutations for a fellow initiate, and the law regarding prisoners, raising, pillaging, looting, and rape. It was a lot to remember. The laws handed down by Duin the Destroyer so long ago covered many elements of warfare, and the Imperial War Gods, Gobaba and the others, were just as particular about how they were served. When training commenced anew the following day, they put their new knowledge of siege warfare to work, as they were instructed on how to build a field redoubt. Then, after every squad's efforts were judged, for the next 2 days they learned how to attack a field redoubt. Then they learned how to dig a ditch, and spent 2 days doing nothing but digging a trench around a redoubt. Then they learned the art of the ambush, then how to move quietly through the swamps, responding to their squad leader's hand gestures as they had been instructed. They learned how to scout, how to report, and how to interrogate a prisoner. All week they practiced. A few different types of artillery were assembled at one end of the field, and the redoubts the cadets had so painstakingly built were smashed to bits as the boys learned how to run a siege engine. The rubble that resulted was made into a huge bonfire. The last 2 days of the mysteries focused on unarmed combat, wrestling, punching, and maneuvers to use against an armed opponent. Rondal, who had always considered himself somewhat weak and puny, surprised himself by toppling Jofab the Giant within moments, using some clever leverage. That's when Rondal realized that his long labor at the mysteries had taken his puny body away and replaced it with a wiry, well-muscled one. When he drew back and pummeled the boy from first squad, he was amazed at just how much power his shoulders and arms gave him. The boy from first squad had to be led away to the War Brothers for tending his shattered nose. Then one day dawned without them being awoken before the sun rose. Instead, they were called from their blankets by a simple horn call for assembly. The units struggled into formation and were finally addressed by the swaggering commandant.
"Well, neophytes, you have truly impressed all of us," he smiled. "Only 4 deaths this time, which makes this one of the more peaceful mysteries. But those brothers will be granted Duin's grace posthumously and be considered initiates. As for the rest of you," he said, grinning. There was a murmur of expectation among the ranks. "When you came here, you were children. Now you are men. When you complete this rite, I will be glad to hail you as my brother in arms. Regardless of what side we fight on, we have all labored through the mystery, and taken from it the blessings of strength." The final ritual involved marching in formation through the gates of Relancor, parading past a throng of well-wishers from the citadel, and trading their wooden swords for the plain steel leaf-shaped infantry swords and steel bracelets that symbolized their completion of the mystery. Then they marched back to the practice ground for the last time, solemnly turned in their banners, and then each of them solemnly drank with wine to the health of them all, from ewers borne by congratulatory war brothers. Then there was more drinking, of a far less religious nature.
"Ishi's tits, I never thought we'd make it through," Rack said, his voice full of relief as he dipped his cup back into the ewer of wine. "If I never see the sun rise again, I'll count myself fortunate."
"What are you going to do now?" asked Handel, looking relaxed for the first time in 6 weeks.
"Back home, to finish up my squirehood," Rax admitted. "But I might secure a place among the Baron's Guard with a Raylan Corps certificate in my kit."
"I'm for home too," Jofard agreed with a smile. "If I take just a little too long getting upriver,
I might just miss out on the end of ploughing season.
You plough? Asked Walven, surprised.
He's big enough to pull one, Dolwyn remarked. I don't plough, Joffard said indignantly, but my father makes me follow the reeves around to make them nervous. It's supposed to teach them how to run the estate.
How about you, Ace?
I'm staying on to take advanced classes, the Ramiran informed them. Siege warfare in particular.
I've already paid my tuition, Walven said proudly.
Siege warfare? Asked Dolwyn, surprised.
Isn't that hideously boring?
No more boring than garrison duty, Walven said. Siege engineers are always in demand. But that's just my next lesson. I plan on getting plenty more after that.
I'm for the free companies, he said, the closest thing to a boast that Rundle had heard from the boy.
I am too. Just a little more directly, Orphal said, chuckling. If I pass the mysteries, I have a billet with the Bloody River Company.
In Gilmora, he added, with a certain amount of relish.
You're going to fight goblins, Dolwyn said enthusiastically.
Last year's goblin invasion of the rich agricultural country had attracted mercenaries from all over, fighting at the king's expense.
I'm for the free companies too, but I have no billet yet.
I'm to go home and train the peasants, Rack said, discouraged. All this beautiful lore about warfare, and I'm going to be making a bunch of clodfoots try to fight.
What about you, Sparks? Asked Walven, curious. Where are you heading, Sir Striker?
I'm staying on, Rondell said. For a while at least. All three of us are.
War mage training. It's supposed to take another 4 weeks. Or more.
Oh! Orphil complained. I was hoping you would come with me to the Bloody River.
I've been to Gilmora, Rondell reminded him, and I've seen enough goblins to last a bloody lifetime. But I expect I'll be back there before long. Watch yourself. Those Gavanni are nasty fighters.
They won't be so bad,
Orphil dismissed. The Bloody River is 3,000 strong infantry and cavalry.
You've never faced the goblins before, Rondell said to his squadmate, simply.
I'll be fine. Hell's after the mysteries. I feel like I could take on the Goblin King himself.
Rondell let the brag pass. They had worked hard. They had achieved much, and they deserved a little over-enthusiasm, he reasoned. He had to admit he was happy that the mysteries were behind him now. He felt strong, he felt dangerous, and he felt as if he had become something more than when he'd started. In fact, he didn't even feel like a mage. He wasn't Sir Rondell, Knight Magi, or even Mage Lord Rondell of Sevendor. He was Striker now. He looked around at his comrades and smiled. He had liked few of them when the trials began, but now he couldn't think of any of them, even annoying Yeetin, with anything but fondness.
My lord,
came a timid voice from the front of their camp.
My lord, Sir Rondell of Sevendor?
It was a young page, no more than 11, wearing a yellow tabard with the arms of Raylan Kaur on them in black.
Yes?
Rondell asked, almost not recognizing his name.
My lord, you are bidden to come to the Master of War Magic's office, he explained nervously. Then I'm to take you to your assigned quarters, at your convenience,
the lad added, when the celebrating cadets looked at him harshly for interrupting their reverie.
All right, sighed Rondell.
There you go, fellas. Duty calls. I've got to go play Mage Lord now. There was a chorus of groans from them, and for the next 10 minutes the initiates, the soldiers, said their farewells. There were more than a few tears, and declarations of admiration abounded. Rondell finally tore himself away, hefted his pack, tucked his new, plain and serviceable infantry sword into his belt, and followed the page. It was odd to be inside Raylan Kaur after camping in its shadow for 6 weeks, but while he had sweated and bled and struggled, the business of the War College went on. He passed pages and soldiers and advanced students and masters as he found Master Valwyn in his office. For all he knew, the man hadn't moved from the spot since he left him, more than a moon ago.
Ah, well done, initiate, he said warmly, rising when he recognized Rondell.
Well done. I've had several good reports of you during your training, and your squad went on to win the bivouac competition. That's outstanding.
He made a note on a piece of parchment in front of him.
Thank you, sir,
Rondell said, coming to attention automatically.
At ease, Master Valwyn dismissed.
I'm looking forward to your war mage classes, he added, as he got up and retrieved Rondel's witchstone from the box on the bookshelf. I've been talking to your fellow apprentice, and he speaks very highly of you.
Really? Snorted Rondel, surprised. Tyndall? Sir? He added belatedly.
Master Valwyn chuckled. Quite so, he agreed, setting the box down on the desk. He's had nothing but praise for you, although he considers you somewhat bookish.
Rondel snorted again.
I'll keep my opinions about him to myself, if you don't mind, sir, he said ruefully.
I thought I detected a little acrimony there, Valwyn said, as he dispelled his spellbinding.
Rondel did the same, which was difficult after 6 weeks of using very little magic. He had to apply himself far more than he anticipated to finish the work, but soon the glittering field around the box fell. Holding his breath, he worried for no good reason that his stone would not be in the box. He opened it. Much to his relief it was, indeed, still there, and his mind rushed to contact it the moment the lid was open.
Ah, Rondel said, as the first waves of power washed through him. I'd forgotten how much I missed that.
I'm envious, chuckled Valwyn. Oh, I'll get one eventually. They already want me to ship to Gilmora and lead a troop of cavalry, but I can't help but covet that kind of power.
It's a heady thing, Rondel agreed.
He eagerly examined his stone, inside and out, until he was satisfied that it was still the powerful shard he'd left there. But it's dangerous, too. I probably shouldn't have been given one, but, well, necessity is a bitch who drives us all, sir.
Look not on it as misplaced in your hands, son, suggested Master Valwyn.
Just early. I was serious, Sir Rondel. The Ward brothers were keeping a very close eye on you and your squad. By all accounts, you are an excellent soldier. From what I understand, after your camp was attacked, instead of pursuing bloody vengeance, your squad focused on the mission. That's admirable and rare. And I also heard how you led the charge through the defenders in the village. Whatever your master was thinking when he gave you that stone, his confidence has not been misplaced.
Rondel wasn't sure what to say to that.
Well, thank you, sir. When do classes begin?
3 days from now, the Master of War Magic informed him. We're still awaiting 6 students. We have 20 from the Mysteries, but there are several more already arrived and waiting. But you have 3 days if you want to get some leave and celebrate a bit.
Rondel thanked the mage and then followed the page deep into the recesses of the fortress, where he was given a room. A double room. There were 2 cots inside, one on each side of the room. As it was designed for 4 soldiers, there was almost enough room for 2, following standard military logic. But Rondel didn't have to guess who his roommate was. He recognized Tyndall's baggage and the trademark disheveled state of his side of the room.
Ishi's tits, he swore angrily. Was there no more room elsewhere?
I was informed that you were to bunk together, the page said diplomatically, by your master's orders.
We'll see about that, Rondel said.
He tipped the boy a penny after he'd carried his baggage inside the room and set it on the press at the end of his bed. Then he sat on the straw tick, closed his eyes, and reached out with his mind. It had been a while, but the spell came back to him easily enough.
Master, it is Rondel, he announced,
when Master Minolin deigned to answer his call.
Rondel, how fared you in camp?
My squad excelled, Master. Thank you for the opportunity.
That's amazing. Well done, lad. How are you holding up after Inarion?
He asked, concerned.
I'm fine, Master, Rondel assured him. The Mysteries were a great distraction, but I am speaking with you because I've been told that Tyndall and I have to bunk together per your orders.
That is correct, Minolin said simply.
But why?
Rondel demanded.
Because I know you two have some business to finish, the spellmonger told him. And avoiding it and avoiding each other isn't going to make it go away. Quite the contrary.
Master, he blames me. I don't want to hear it, Minolin snapped.
Figure it out, Rondel. There's a lot going on right now, and I need both of you trained, fit, and ready to do my bidding. Soon.
Master, are we not always doing your bidding?
Do my bidding better, the Mage Lord corrected. You still have a few weeks of war magic school. Try to work out whatever it is between you before you return to Sevendor.
But, Master,
do it,
insisted the spellmonger. I know Tyndall is kind of an ass, but I still need him, and you, and I need you to be able to work together. Anything else? He asked impatiently. No, master, admitted Rundle sourly. Then take a day or so to relax, and then prepare for your studies. If I recall correctly, War Mage School was only slightly better than infantry training. Yes, master, Rundle said, and ended the connection. Damn, he said out loud. For 2 days, Rundle avoided Tyndall mostly by being elsewhere. At first he spent his time in the village tavern, saying a more thorough goodbye to his squadmates as they took barges or horses toward their destinations one by one. Gurundor and Yeetin, who were scheduled to continue to war magic classes, were housed in the barracks in the fortress, but spent plenty of time in the tavern, the Iron Gate, named for the device of Relancor. The village inn was a busy place, thrice the size of a normal inn, with 2 additional bays and a side house. With soldiers, warriors, knights, and mercenaries constantly coming and going, the inn had a lot of business, and a lot of fights. The public room at the Iron Gate's heart was the haunt of old soldiers, mercenaries, and students in the art of warfare who lingered near the war college. The decor reflected its use, with souvenirs of campaigns, banners of defeated enemies, ancient swords notched with battle, and battered pieces of armor hanging from the rafters and walls. Tyndall seemed to be avoiding Rondal as much as Rondal was avoiding him. He seemed to spend an awful lot of time working with various masters of arms in the practice yard, honing his swordplay. Sometimes he worked with a mock mage blade, sometimes with a cavalry sword, sometimes with an infantry sword. But he was getting better and better, Rondal could see from afar, even though he still made a lot of mistakes. Rondal tried his best to put him out of his mind. He had a somewhat different perspective after the mysteries. He knew it was unfair of Tyndall to blame him for Astasia's death, but that did not deter his guilt over the matter. While the sting of it had faded, the burden of it had only grown. He imagined what she might say to him several times, but each time he found himself thinking such maudlin thoughts, he found something physical and punishing to do. When he got back to his room, if he was first, he tried to get to sleep before Tyndall got in. Tyndall, he noticed, always seemed to be asleep when he came in. They spoke barely 5 words to each other in 3 days. Finally, they were called to the assembly hall on the first floor for their first classes of war magic school, and he was able to let the volume of work occupy his mind instead. There were 37 pupils for the class, most of them young magi with the ink still wet on their charters. A few were older and had sought out the training because they wanted to go to the penumbra and try their luck to find a stone. Compared to infantry training, it was almost as studious and civilized as Inarian Academy. Master Valwyn was the one who addressed them first, giving a long rambling speech on the history of war magic, its current utility, and the importance of the magical core in the defense of the kingdom. He referenced the goblin invasion several times, but did not dwell on it. Valwyn instead spoke about the mad mage of Faris and the threat he posed, and the gallant attack by the best war magi in the duchies that defeated him. He spoke of great war magi of old, told of their achievements, and praised the brave men and women fighting in the new arcane orders. Rondal listened but did not pay attention. He was just grateful for the warm clothes, dry bed, and full belly his now muscular body seemed to cherish. As much as he had come to appreciate the brutal efficiency of the soldier's life, he still felt more at home around the smell of dust and parchment than he did leather and steel. A few other prominent magi spoke, both militant and civilian, and Mage Lord Hatarian, the new royal court mage and former censor general, addressed them with a plea for more recruits for duty in the penumbra, and a commendation for the nascent Iron Ring order that was beginning to police its frontier. Then there was a light reception, allowing the students and the faculty to casually discuss the curriculum and readings, of which there were many. Master Valwyn would be lecturing them in the philosophy of war magic he knew, as well as defensive combat spells. The compact war mage was a veteran of Faris and several years honorable service on the frontier with Alshar. He wore a smart little red cap. Rondal found out later it was the traditional cap of a professional war mage seeking employment in some quarters, had a lively manner about him. A good choice for the job, Rondal decided.
Beside him, Master Cirison would be teaching them everything he knew about war wands. Master Renando of Cormier would discuss the basics of using a mage blade, as well as running several practical drills, and Master Loico himself would be teaching them offensive combat magic. There were other teachers and lecturers on other subjects, but those were the ones Rondol was most interested in. He gravitated toward one side of the trestle table where Gurrendor was hovering over a plate of tiny sausages and a stack of buns. Rondol grabbed one of both and started nibbling. Rondol looked around the room. "A bit of a stuffy crowd for war magi," he murmured to his former squadmate.
"The real tough ones are at the front," the other mage pointed out. "That's probably where I'm going eventually."
"Wait long enough, the front will come here," he remarked sourly between bites. "Some of these fellows are rather good," Rondol pointed out. Gurrendor ceded the point. "You don't go up against Oral Pratt with a couple of cantrips and a winning attitude. Master Valwyn is famous for some of the spells he oversaw at the conquest of Faerys, and Master Loico, he's the best." The mention of the war made him think again of Caffin of Gaia, and how much Rondol hated the boy. Now that he understood what a sword could do, he looked forward to the day where he could use one on Caffin. Or a wand. Or a rock. Rondol wasn't picky. As if to add to his sour mood, Tyndall picked that moment to blunder by.
"My lords," he said with slight exaggeration. He was wearing a green velvet tunic, suitable for formal occasions, and Rondol was loath to admit he looked quite regal in it.
"I hope that lecture didn't keep you awake."
"After infantry training," Gurrendor said with a sneer, "there's not much that could keep me awake. My bones still ache. So what have they been keeping you busy with while we've been at the mysteries?"
"Mostly swordplay," Tyndall admitted. "There are some outstanding swordsmen here, masters of the mage blade. I've been sparring as much as possible, and occasionally hitting the war magic library."
"I didn't know there was a war magic library," Rondol said thoughtfully, "and I'm twice as surprised that you knew of it."
"I like to take the opportunity to improve myself," Tyndall said vainly. "There are whole tomes of nastiness in there. Some of it is even prescribed, marked with a big 'for educational purposes only,' penalty for use, letter attached. But fascinating. I look forward to taking a run at it," Rondol said cordially.
"You'll love it, Ron," Tyndall assured.
"And I actually passed a few examinations after you left Inarion," he added proudly. "Mathematics, geometry, basic elemental theory, practical cantrips, a couple of others."
"I'm delighted," Rondol said through clenched teeth.
Tyndall finally caught that Rondol was behaving coolly toward him, and a look of confusion crossed his face.
He said, looking at Gurrendor, "can we have a moment's privacy?"
Gurrendor sized up Tyndall.
"Let me know if you need help, Stryker," he said, and headed for the other end of the table.
"What is wrong with you?"
Tyndall demanded in a whisper when they were out of earshot.
"Whatever do you mean?"
Rondol asked, sarcastically, as he bit into a sausage.
"I mean you've been acting like I took a dump in your hat since the moment I got here," he said harshly.
"I have been occupied with my studies," the older boy said, irritated. "Did you need me to brush your hair or something?"
"You've been avoiding me,"
Tyndall accused. "Like I have the pox.
How do I know you don't?"
Rondol challenged.
"See?"
Tyndall pointed out.
"That's just not like you."
"What isn't like me?"
"You, acting like a..."
Thankfully, they were interrupted by the imposing figure of Master Hartarion. A high mage like them, he carried his shard of Irionite in a golden cage around his neck. He towered over them both. The former head of the Royal Censorate of Magic, he looked less at ease in civilian life than he had as head of the Order. Here he fit in admirably.
"Hail, good knights, magi," he said, smiling just a little too broadly. "I am pleased to see you both here. I've been speaking with your master frequently of late, and he asked me to check on your condition. So, still have all your limbs, I see," he chuckled.
"The knight is still young, master," Tyndall said slyly, "but we appreciate your oversight, don't we, Rondol?"
"Of course," Rondol agreed politely. "And we look forward to the opportunity to improve our skills."
"That's encouraging to hear," Hartarion sighed, filling his wine cup from the table. "As busy as things are at the capital now, we're going to need all the warriors we can field in Gilmora this summer. I expect you two will be prominent."
"That depends entirely on the mood of our master,"
Rondel said, before Tyndall could say anything. He has yet to disclose what tasks he has in mind for us. I'm sure fighting goblins will be mentioned. Tyndall grinned. Sir Tyndall was just telling me how proud he was at passing his recent examinations at Inarion, Master Hartarian, Rondel said conversationally. Didn't your niece attend Inarion? Only for 6 months, he sighed. She did most of her schooling at Alla, although I dare say she has picked up a few things at court, he said. Rondal could guess there was a story there, but he didn't feel confident to ask of the mysterious Lady Isili. She had been a close aide to their master during the Battle of Timberwatch, but apparently they'd had a falling out. Tyndall knew something about it, but he had yet to share the intelligence with Rondal due to its sensitive nature, and it remained a mystery. So, what subjects did you complete then, Sir Tyndall? Mathematics, lesser elemental theory, geometry, he said. Each admission of success in the basic levels of knowledge, making the boy squirm in front of the most senior mage in the kingdom. Don't forget practical cantrips, Rondel reminded him, with just a hair too much enthusiasm. Yes, Tyndall said slowly, practical cantrips. Master Hartarian looked at the boys thoughtfully. Well done, he said without much eagerness. And how about you, Sir Rondel?
I am well into my intermediate course of study in thaumaturgy, Master, he answered, ignoring Tyndall's embarrassment. I'm hoping to pursue some enchantment, if I have the opportunity.
Thaumaturgy and enchantment, Hartarian said, impressed. Those are difficult subjects.
You'll find Sir Rondal excels at the difficult, Tyndall said, recovering somewhat. It's rare you find a book without his nose somewhere in the vicinity.
One must put them somewhere, Rondal said smoothly. The kingdom will be full of opportunities for a couple of bright young lads like yourself, Hartarian assured them, ignoring their blatant rivalry. I look forward to reporting to your master how diligent you've been.
When the court mage had wandered off to speak to some more senior war magi, Tyndall stepped uncomfortably close to Rondal.
What the hell's was that?
What? Rondal asked, innocently.
Mentioning my examinations, he said angrily, his nostrils flaring. I thought you were proud of your examinations, Rondal shrugged.
Not in my remedial classes, Tyndall said. Nor was that news for Master Hartarian's ears. He's the royal court wizard.
You said it plainly enough for mine and Gurrendor's, Rondal countered.
You know exactly what I mean, Tyndall said, his face burning.
Do I? Rondal said, pushing past him. You mean how I pointed out that you are years behind me in study? Or how you actually passed a few remedial examinations, finally?
Well, both.
Neither. Ah, you are infuriating, Tyndall fumed as he stomped off.
Gurrendor came back the moment Tyndall left the reception.
What was that about?
A difference of opinion, Rondal said, tight-lipped. It's nothing. What do you say we leave this lovely and utterly uninteresting reception and walk down to the village? I'll buy, he added. Among his other belongings he'd made the reacquaintance of, his purse was one of the dearest, and while he rarely indulged in drink to any great degree, Rondal was suddenly feeling like doing so.
You're buying? Gurrendor, who had arrived at Raylancourt with little coin in his purse, asked excitedly.
Then let's go. I'm suddenly finding myself quite thirsty.
Me too, Rondal said, his eyes narrowing.
Perhaps, just perhaps, Tyndall would have the same idea, and they would chance to meet on the way down or back.
Classes began in earnest the next day, and despite drinking far more than he was accustomed to, Rondal managed to make it back to bed in good order. Interestingly enough, Tyndall had been in his bunk neither when he arrived nor later when he awoke. Rondal was concerned for a moment and thought about calling him mind to mind, but then decided against it. Instead, he wandered down to the mess hall, grabbed a mug of ale and a sweet roll, and headed for class. It was war wands today, taught by Master Sirison, a veteran war mage long retired, and it was in an auxiliary dining hall that had been converted to use as a classroom by the expedient of placing 20 long benches in front of the main table. Master Sirison was situated behind the lectern. He looked 5 years older than dirt to Rondal, with a long flowing beard and voluminous red robes.
Rondol quickly realized that Master Searson was enamored of the sound of his own voice. Tyndall was there too, sitting to the right and all the way in the back. Rondol made his way to the left and moved all the way down to the front. Master Searson had just begun the meat of his lecture.
"The war wand, along with the mage blade, is the basic weapon of the war magi," the old instructor said, demonstrating with an 18-inch plain wooden wand. "Why use a wand? First, we should ask, what is a wand?"
"Any wand?"
"A stick," answered someone from behind Rondol. There was a titter of giggles.
"Yes, a stick. A wand is a stick. A humble piece of wood, usually no longer than your forearm and no thicker than your wrist. As such, it is the basis of many other weapons. Put a rock at the end, it is a mace. Put a thick piece of metal at the end, it becomes a hammer. Sharpen it, it is an axe. A thin piece of pointy metal at the end, a spear. A wire or rope, it becomes a whip. But a war wand is not a mere heft or handle," he continued, beginning to pace slowly in front of the class. "The purpose of the war wand is not to become other weapons, but to become a weapon itself. So, why use a wand?"
"It's free," came another mage's answer. That inspired some giggles too.
"Sometimes," conceded Master Searson, "but that is not why. It is merely a contributing factor. No, we use a stick for our war magic because, first and foremost, it points." He indicated the function by pointing at various things around the room. "As I'm sure we all remember from geometry, any two points connected will form a straight line, and by extension, a ray. From the tip of the wand," he said, demonstrating with his inert model, "extending in a ray from base and point, the line will continue to be straight right off into infinity. But it only points to one direction. Direction is very important for many war magic spells. One does not want to hit one's friend, after all, but the foe. Sticks excel at pointing."
More chuckles. The old man smiled at the response and continued.
"Secondly, we use a wand for our war magic in many cases because the effect of the spell we choose to bring down our enemies may be too potent to discharge in close proximity to our persons without injury. The war wand has the advantage of keeping the magical death you have conjured at least a span away from your delicate fingers. Indeed, a protective element is often a component of the enchantments used for war wands. It also helps preserve the device for multiple uses." He walked in front of the lectern and suddenly threw the stick to the floor.
"Thirdly, we use war wands because, unlike our mage blades, they are disposable. That is, any given piece of wood will only hold so much enchantment before the arcane pressures overcome its natural resiliency, usually no more than one type of spell, and with limited energy. Once those charges are discharged, well, your war wand may make a lovely conversation piece, but don't try to re-enchant one. Only a few specialized woods, such as weirwood or socohol, can safely be used more than once, which is why weirwood is so precious."
He picked another stick out of a basket of them next to the lectern.
"A war wand, once exhausted, can be safely discarded without regret. Indeed, carrying a variety of war wands can be a decided advantage for the war mage, as not every permutation of magical expression is going to be unchallenged. Finding your only means of attack is pointless because of counterspells is disappointing. Being able to switch from, say, a direct physical attack to a more subtle magical one gives the war mage a powerful advantage."
Rondol knew the pragmatic use of that rule himself. Twice during the siege at Boval, he had tried to discharge a wand at a goblin shaman, only to have the spell negated by some arcane defense. Being able to switch to another wand with a different profile quickly had saved his life.
"The basic theory is simple. After a proper preparation, the wand is invested with energy, directed, shaped, and tuned by the war mage that can be converted into a useful, and by that I mean deadly, purpose. These spells can cause fire, plasma, lightning, pure physical force,
sound, and far more subtle and insidious effects. Today, we are going to use a very basic enchantment to create a simple Siskoyin wand. These were once very popular in antiquity, and were even provided to guardsmen in the great cities of the Majocracy to break up fights.
"Are we just going to learn about stunning ones?" asked a young mage Rondal didn't know.
"There are over 300 varieties of war wand catalogued here in Relancor's library. Some haven't been used since the Majocracy, and practicing war magi have been adding their own variations for centuries. While we are using the Siskoyin wand as an example, I encourage you to explore the other varieties available to you. You should have plenty of opportunity to find the wand enchantments that work best for you. We have provided a sufficiency of wand blanks for your use. None of them are what I would call superior for such duty, but all are adequate for simple use. Today we will be learning the basics of the craft, and over the next several days we will be expanding that knowledge to include the basic permutations of force one can manifest through a war wand." After that, he invited everyone up to select a blank upon which to practice the craft, while he began sketching the runes used in the process on the slate behind him.
"What kind did you get?"
Tyndall asked, when Rondal answered his call mind to mind.
"What does it matter?" Rondal asked, annoyed. "Is it really important?"
"I was just wondering. I like wand work."
"I know. Big hero of Beauvoir Castle. I remember. I was just curious."
"I got an oak."
"Birch,"
Rondal replied with a mental grunt.
"Happy?"
"Blissful."
"Why are you so mad at me?"
"Go play with your wand." Rondal ended the connection abruptly and focused on the lecture. Master Sirison outlined the process for proper vetting and examination of the piece before serious enchantment began, and went over the signs that a wand was unworthy of use. Rondal did his best to ignore the seething he felt when he even thought of his fellow apprentice, right up to the point of charging the wand.
"Now, the advantage of the Siskoyin wand is its relative ease of enchantment. Once you have done the proper preparation, it is time to charge it, using the filter of your emotions to determine the strength of the charge. Don't be discouraged if your first attempts lack luster. Some war magi who build deadly wands with ease still find the Siskoyin unwilling to be bridled by their talent. But using the Neckarth rune as a conduit allows you to add emotional energy to filter the magical. The more intense the emotion you can generate, the more powerful the result."
Rondal understood that. The Neckarth rune had a strong emotional component, which kept it from being useful for many sophisticated magics. But for such simplistic things as stunning a man unconscious, it was of good utility. As he poured power into the rune, after inscribing it lightly on the wand, Tyndall tried yet again to speak mind to mind. Rondal did not answer, but the resulting surge in emotion almost made him lose focus and wreck the enchantment. Angrily, he maintained control and poured the anger into the enchantment. When he had completed the charge, Master Sirison instructed them in creating the mnemonic trigger that would release the effect.
"Theoretically," the old war mage continued, when the final stage of the ritual was complete, "a Siskoyin should have a potent effect on the target within 50 feet. Further than that, and the effect diffuses quickly. While that may not seem helpful in a battle, it does make Siskoyin an excellent alternative to a deadlier device, and many higher-level war magi stupidly forget to cast counterspells. I have seen contests where the Siskoyin wand settled the matter. The stunning effect lasts no more than 10 minutes, which is why this wand is favored by foot wizards well read enough to have mastered it. That is apparently enough time to get away from a bandit, or an angry customer," he chuckled, as did several of the magi in the class. "It will also stun a horse of decent size for at least 5 minutes, or a hound for an hour, based on the strength of the charge, which often puts a cavalryman at a disadvantage." They continued through the rest of the exercise, until they had finished with a binding rune. When they were done, the lightly etched wand felt pleasantly warm in his hands. That was a bit of an illusion. Most of the heat had been absorbed by his own hands. But he was satisfied with the result. Not the most complicated wand in the world, but he was glad he had learned the craft to make it.
Now we are going to test our devices, Master Sirison said with a twinkle in his eye. To do that, let us pair up. I trust none of these are so powerful that we must fear injury, but I have had a room prepared with additional rashes to cushion any falls. He led them all to another room across the corridor, smaller than the lecture hall. Then he invited the class to square off against each other two at a time. The first few bouts were exciting, due to the novelty. A tall man in green went up against a shorter, stockier man in yellow. The man in yellow prevailed, sending the man in green crumbling to the floor. "Drag him into the corner until he wakes," Master Sirison instructed. "I'd like to make the observation that if one wishes to use a war wand, then one should consider carefully when pointing. As good as wands are at pointing, they are only as good as the eye of the master who wields them. The secret," he confided, "is to forget aiming, as you would do with a bow or arbalest, and simply point," he said. "Imagine the wand as a finger. When you point with your finger, you never miss. Point with your wand and have faith that your hand and eye know better together than you do." The next bout was between a slender young woman with an unfortunate face and a well-muscled mage from the south. The man from the south was slower and joined the man in green, snoring in the corner. "Alacrity is frequently a component in successfully using a wand," Master Sirison lectured. "The young man made the mistake of a six-syllable mnemonic, whereas the young lady's was but a three. You can see the difference a three syllables can make," he said, as the southern mage was dragged away. Two by two, the class tried their wands. Gurundor was taken down by a Gilmoran mage, who in turn was taken down by Rondal's comrade, Yeetin. Both were dragged to the corner just as the man in green was waking. Then it was Rondal's turn. He walked to the other end of the chamber and waited for an opponent. Of course, Tyndall had to be the one to face him. "You sure you want to do this?" Rondal asked, mind to mind. "Are you kidding? This is fun. Usually when I blast someone, they stay blasted. This way we get to see who the better wand maker is." Rondal didn't reply. He was busy fuming over Tyndall's arrogance and competitive nature. The big, stupid puppy thought this was a game, another chance for him to score an easy victory. Rondal planned on disabusing him of that notion. He waited until Master Sirison dropped his arm and told them to begin, and while Tyndall was still raising his arm, Rondal merely bent his wrist and elbow. "Pen all," he said, as quickly as he could, as he willed the wand to discharge. He'd chosen the word, the old Narasi term for ass, because of its brevity. He felt the surge of power through the stick as it fired. Tyndall crumpled to the floor before his wand was halfway raised. "Impressive," Master Sirison nodded approvingly. "Very efficiently played, Sir Rondal." Instead of 10 minutes, however, Sir Tyndall was still snoring more than 30 minutes later, when Master Sirison finally used a waking charm on him to rouse him from consciousness.
"Where is everyone?"
he asked, confused. Rondal watched from just outside of the corridor, where his fellow apprentice could not spot him.
"Gone already," the old man chuckled. "An excellent display of wand work."
"Thank you, Master," Tyndall said as he struggled to his feet.
"Oh, I didn't mean you," the Master War Mage laughed. "No, Sir Tyndall, you never even uttered the command. Your fellow, Sir Rondal, took the bout, and from the length of your slumber, I'd say he put a fair sum of emotional energy into the device. To look at him, you wouldn't think he'd be capable, but his effect lasted the longest of any of them."
"Really?"
Tyndall asked, sitting up.
"Here I thought I was better at war wands. It seems Sir Rondal has improved," the master said diplomatically as he helped the mage knight to his feet.
"Yes," Tyndall said, shaking his head. "He's full of surprises."
Smiling smugly to himself, Rondal left without seeing Tyndall, heading down to the library to begin research on new wand types. He was suddenly feeling quite competitive.